to me to hear.
Welcome, 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 all listeners who have found this, the Holy Grail, the, the secret fellowship that is not so secret anymore. You have arrived at the Pirate Monk Podcast, courtesy of SamsonSociety.org. And today I have with me my wonderfully beautiful...
Oh, I get to be beautiful today.
Yes, co-host Nate Larkin, the author of Samson and the Pirate Monks. I'm your host, David Mullen. And, of course, as always, we have our fearless engineer,
Mondo.
And if there's a we need a dog or something so we can say, and his fearless mutt.
All right. That's the assignment. Sound effects.
Hey, did you make the meeting last Monday night?
No, you know I didn't make the meeting.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you got a John boat with a trolling motor.
I couldn't get back into town because of the flood.
Yes. For those of you who don't know, we did have a flood last week. If you'd like to contribute to the efforts of flood relief in the Nashville area, you would not believe what went on here. You can go to redcross.org, and they have several different things that you can click on there for the Nashville flood. See, we have, like, probably 85% of the people who were involved in this flood actually don't live in a floodplain of any description. There would be no reason for you ever to have flood insurance. And so
most people didn't.
Most people didn't. So, in fact, in a neighborhood of about 100 people, Nate saw a report that said only 2 out of those people had flood insurance. So there you have most of these neighborhoods, whole sections of town that are underwater, things that are not even close to rivers, but maybe near a creek or something like that.
Yeah.
And the rain, it was not a 10-year flood. It was not a 30-years flood. It was not a 100-years flood. They are thinking it's more along the line of a 500-years flood, which would be something that would be impossible to calculate because it didn't keep records 500 years ago. But today, or this week, is week zero. So you know, in 2510, we should be looking for another flood. And I'm just trying to say how big it is. I don't think people realize.
No, and it was pretty much ignored by national media. I mean, they did some coverage.
Right, Anderson Cooper came down after he got guilted into it by people tweeting to him so often.
Oh, really?
And we do appreciate CNN coming down and doing the work there. And the news, two people, Christine Mandela, just did a wonderful job, I think, on keeping people just updated on the whole situation. But if you haven't seen it, please go to YouTube, look up Nashville Flood 2010. You'll see the pictures. Go to redcross.org, and you will be able to click on ways to get in touch with people. But one of the most amazing things, though, Nate, is that people still came to the meeting on Monday.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. Allie and I were in Athens, Georgia that weekend.
How did that go?
That was a great event in Athens. Andy Hines and Joe Buca and his Remedial Bible Study guys put together this evening. It was a Friday evening. About 175 guys showed up at Athens Academy. And then we had a pastor's meeting Saturday morning and a comeback meeting for guys interested in experiencing a Samson meeting firsthand. We ran a meeting. And afterwards, the guys decided to start not just one meeting and not two meetings, but 3 meetings.
That's great.
In Greater Athens.
That's great.
So that was great. So, but anyway, meanwhile, I'm monitoring conditions back home. And the rain is coming, and it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And good friends doing a men's retreat, a bunch of Samson guys doing a men's retreat, had to evacuate.
Right.
And when they went back, the retreat center was
gone. oh, Lord.
So we couldn't come back into town. We delayed our return by a couple days until the floodwaters receded. I sent out a dove, and it returned with an olive branch, and then we came home. But on Monday, I got a couple of text messages from guys saying, hey, is there going to be a meeting tonight at church? Well, church had been canceled the day before. The building was a virtual island.
Mm.
The roads were still closed. The National Guard was in town. There was a dusk to dawn curfew. Mm. So I texted back, no, probably not a meeting tonight. Turns out I was wrong.
Yeah.
17 guys made their way to the meeting, made their way to the building, still had a meeting.
By canoe, by kayak,
yeah.
By inner tube, whatever means necessary, but they made it to the...
How cool is that?
That's really cool. But, you know, people who are about Samson, who are really about doing the work, you know, they show up. And when they show up, you know, we were talking this morning about what is it really that makes a good meeting, like, because, you know, for me, like, for years, it just seemed like that when you came to a meeting and you were listening, a lot of times it's just a place for people to come and to just bitch and moan, really, about certain things and like maybe do a confession. And you said, well, David, if that's the kind of thing, if that was your experience, like, you missed the whole thing. And
yeah, if that was your, we had this conversation this morning, David. A Samson group where the meeting has degenerated into a weekly confessional session,
right,
or a bitch and moan session where,
right,
I'm going to complain about wife, girlfriend, kids,
right,
job, whatever.
Right.
All of those things need to be on the table.
Right. I mean,
we need to be able to
it.
Talk about.
Yeah.
We need to be able to talk about our failures. There needs to be nothing off limits. But if the meeting has degenerated to that,
mm-hmm, right,
it's no longer a healthy meeting, and it's a sign that. You know, we say it so often, Samson has meetings, but it's not about the meetings.
It's the meetings after the meetings.
And it's the days between the meetings.
Yeah.
It's a 24/7 deal, and Samson really lives and dies in those daily phone calls between a guy and his Silas.
Yeah, I think that is probably the ones that you really can tell when they've really made that step is when they make the call, the daily phone call.
Right, yeah. So... but if I don't yet have a Silas, let's say, you know, I go to Samson and for the first time I admit my failures, I confess it, I have this great feeling of relief, I get,
sure,
a sense of authenticity, I can say things here I can't say anyplace else, I leave feeling better, and
sure,
all right? And next week I go back and I do the same thing.
Mm.
And next week I do the same. After a while, though...
And I feel more better? And yeah, more better, and then, but then after a while.
That's right. After a while, if that's all it is, if it's this rhythm of weekly confession,
mm-hmm,
I'm not going to see improvement, not a lot of improvement,
mm,
and I'm going to begin to lose hope, and the meeting is going to begin to lose steam.
Right. There you go.
There's a great phrase in 12-step recovery that I like. They describe... a healthy meeting is a place for us to bring experience, strength, and hope. That's not to say that we can't talk about our failures. In fact, sometimes the most encouraging thing I can do for another guy is to talk about my failure, because then he knows he's not alone.
Right.
But I also, when I come to a meeting, I need to hear what somebody's done that's gone right, a skill that they've acquired that they can pass on to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only going to be making that progress if they are involved in this new way of life on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can get better a week at a time.
Mm.
I don't think we can make significant spiritual progress if we're only being transparent once a week.
Mm.
It has to be a daily thing. When it is a daily thing, progress happens. And I've got something to talk about, and I don't have to wait 7 days, 6 days, 5 days, 4 days to get to a meeting so that I can confess.
Right.
I can talk about my misstep, and I'm going to make a misstep, whether it progresses to a slip or not, I'm going to make missteps every day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I need to be able to process those real time with the brothers I'm walking with, certainly with my Silas and maybe with some other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we come to the meeting, yeah, maybe a new guy who doesn't have a Silas, he hasn't been honest in a group before, we'll give him some room, step back, let him do it two or three times. But we don't want the meeting to turn into that phrase of yours that I like, a little throwback from Roman days.
A vomitorium.
Yeah. We don't just want it to become a vomitorium.
Yeah.
All of us need to do that, you know, we've got to do that vomiting from time to time, but let's do that in relationship with a Silas. Let's do that for one another. And then let's come to the meetings to bring experience, strength, and hope.
You know, one of the best groups that I know of is that really exemplifies what you're talking about, that sort of arc of just learning what you want Samson to be and then what it actually becomes and all those things is the group down in Palatka.
That group, they've kind of gone through infancy and adolescence, and they're really, I think, moving into adulthood as a group.
You know, I have an interview with those guys. Should we listen to that?
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's take a listen to that. And we're back at the Pirate Month podcast, and we've been down at the University of Florida inaugural.
You sure it isn't Florida State?
I'm positive.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, I think that went over like a lead balloon at the last meeting. But here at the we've been at the inaugural event, which is the Pirate Monk Fraternity Weekend.
Fraternity Weekend, yeah.
And here at the University of Florida, and several groups came in to help us, and one of those was the group from Palatka. You say it, Nate.
Well, I pronounced it in a more cultured way.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I say Palatka, but probably that's wrong.
Sound smart.
That sounds like
Palatka. Right. We're here from Palatka.
Palatka, the Palatka Pirate Panthers and Panther Pirates, the P3s. I like that.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, see, because I'm from here. You know that. All y'all know that. But, like, when I was a kid in high school, like, we always played the Palatka Panthers, you know, in football. I hear they're not so good now. But anyway, why don't you introduce our friends, you know?
Well, we got a couple great guys here who I met for the first time almost 3 years ago. Hard to believe it was that long ago.
Yeah.
At the very first 48 Hours of Frankness weekend in Tennessee. Justin Tripp was there, and Jeff Brooks was there.
Wow.
And how cool to know that they went back and dug in and started building a band of brothers.
Mm.
It didn't happen overnight, did it, Jeff?
No, sir, it didn't. Actually, it was a little difficult in the beginning in the sense that we had guys coming and going. You know, we'd have guys that would come in, kind of get stuff off their chests, and then it felt better, and then they'd go back out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
But what we saw over a period of time was guys would come back with a lot of regret that they didn't stay, and they would come back with additional baggage and additional issues, and we'd have to work through that kind of stuff.
Man, I see that so often.
That's a really good word right there, right? It's like, golly.
Well, I think all of us guys, you know, there's a part of us, we're built for intimacy, we're built for relationships, we want brothers. At the same time, we want to be self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
We hate to have to surrender to other people.
Mm-hmm.
We would prefer to be able to do it ourselves.
Right.
And, it's strange, even after all these years, I still have this kind of love-hate relationship with brotherhood.
Yeah, it like brings me along on these trips and then makes me stay like in another hotel and stuff.
That is not true.
That's the hate part.
That is not
true.
Now
you two, Justin, Jeff, y'all hang out? You know, I mean, are y'all kind of the driving force behind the Palatka
group? We and I'd say a couple other guys, we've grown in more than just the group. It's developed some friendships and relationships. We catch up for breakfast. We get to call and communicate over the phone on a personal level inside church and outside of church, which has really given the group a core, a backbone to stand on. Jeff's been one of the main driving forces of our group, but God's placed a few other guys in his path and our the way of our group to really drive it home and give us a good core group to build off of. So.
Hey, describe for us kind of the stages of group growth. You had a small core of guys when you got started.
Right.
You had people cycling in and out.
Right.
At what point did it start to feel like it was really beginning to gel?
I would say about 2 years into it.
Really?
That's whenever the guys started coming back, ones that had kind of faded off there and realized, you know, I really do need this in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would start coming back. And once they came back, they stayed. They stayed.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I mean, our numbers have grown up, you know, upwards of 20s.
Mm-hmm. How long have y'all been doing it?
Total, a little over 3 years. Yeah.
And you've been, both of you, Justin, you were there?
I think I came in, I think, 2 weeks after the group started.
That's pretty much the beginning.
Pretty much.
So, okay, so then let's chase that rabbit a little bit, because, you know, we get this question so much. If y'all listen to the podcast, you've heard, well, we can't get people to come. We can't get anybody to come, you know.
Right.
And of course, you went through that stage. So
we went through that. There was times I kind of got discouraged, you know, as the one who was leading it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, there'd be times we only had four guys there, you know, for 3 or 4 weeks in a row. And that gets a little discouraging, you know. But the fact that, you know, we did a lot of prayer.
Yeah.
We were diligent and steadfast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what actually got us through.
Yeah.
You know, that was just an attack.
Right. And a lot of people will, exactly. And a lot of people will, like, marginalize that, push that to the side and say, well, prayer. But, like, I mean, we do have an enemy that doesn't want us in these groups. And this is our main source of fighting that stuff, you know. But on the pragmatic side, just to be helpful to people who are, like, maybe giving them some suggestions of, like, I mean, how did you interest guys? I mean, did you go out and proselytize? Did you hand out the book? Did you beat people over the head with a stick? What did you do?
Kidnap anybody?
Yeah.
We did that once or twice.
Yeah, we have. We've been known to go to people's
press
houses.
Press people
and
into
draw
service.
Them in
That's
truck.
What pirates do, you know.
Exactly. You're coming with us.
Yeah. We really, some of it was word of mouth. Some of it, for the guys who really got plugged in, I think they noticed the relationship that was developed. Prayer, our group is really bathed in prayer.
Right.
It goes hand in hand with our group. It's a guarantee it's going to happen every week. Mm-hmm. And some of those guys noticed it on Sunday mornings and throughout the week, the differences, the relationships. You said it a minute ago that men need that relationship. And some of those guys noticed it. And, mm-hmm. and when they saw that relationship between a few of the guys in the church, mm-hmm. outside of the church, mm-hmm. I'd say some of them were jealous.
Yeah.
And slowly, slowly a few of those guys started showing up, really reluctant at first. But after 3 to 4 weeks of sitting there and seeing the level of intimacy we had, mm-hmm. and the honesty we were able to put out there, guys kind of just caught on and it started growing. It like a wildfire, pretty quick.
That's great.
And food works too, because for a while we were having breakfasts at the church.
Yep. Yeah.
And you walk onto the property and smell that bacon, and like, what's going on over there?
Bacon's a good way.
Oh man, that's wrong.
So bathe.
See, books.
Bathe in prayer and bathe in bacon.
Bathe in bacon.
Baptized in bacon, actually.
Yeah, right. We got the Holy Spirit and bacon going on in our men's group.
Right, that's good. And when do y'all meet normally?
We meet on Monday nights at 7 p.m.
Wow.
We actually meet off campus from the church. I mean, it is an outreach home that that is associated with First Assembly there in Palatka. However, we're not necessarily.
It's kind of ecumenical.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a big word.
We're,
yes.
I mean,
cool.
The pastor knows what's going on to an extent, but he's a little jealous too because he's not a. He can't really be involved because of the circumstances. But
we get that.
He's
too.
Got plenty of his trustees and deacons and all that are part of the group, and he understands what we're doing over there.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
That's
good stuff. So you go through that stage, then the next stage would be that you people, as you said, leave, and you just. The steadfastness is sort of what keeps them up, because then they come back around. It might take 6 months, it might take a year.
Right. And I call them repeatedly.
Right.
In the sense that, not in a harassing way, but I will call them and say, hey, you know,
hey, we're still here.
Miss you. We're still here. We're still meeting. Or if I see them out and about, I'll say, hey, we still meet on Mondays. You know, you're welcome to join us, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
But
he gets me to do the harassing part.
He's a muscle in the group.
Yeah, I see that.
But it's a God thing.
It's
a God thing.
And how old are you guys? And what's the age range in your group?
We go from 22 years old up to, I think we've got a 60-year-old.
Yeah.
60 plus.
Yeah. That's great. So, and if people want to get in touch with you,
How what's a good way
for the website?
Through a website.
Our website. Through the Samson website.
Are we labeled on the Samson site? I don't know. Have you registered? We got a lot of unregistered groups.
We did three and a half years ago.
Because of the things involved with it.
Oh, so, I see.
I let him do the computer work.
Yes, smarty pants.
Yeah. All right, well, let's check into that. I don't know whether the Palatka
Press. That or I can leave you myself.
Do you want to put our numbers on the internet? We don't mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Whatever you want to do, you know.
Okay. My name is Justin Tripp. I'm 386, area code 972-0296, and you're welcome to call me at any time.
I'm Jeff Brooks, and my number is 386-793-7748.
And we'll be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast. Amazing work they're doing down there in Palatka, the Panther Pirate Monks of Palatka. And I'm just real proud of everything that Justin and those guys are doing. Hey, did you get any letters this week?
I did. The mailman managed to wade in with a couple. There's one I want to read. It opens this way. Hi, my name is Denny, and I'm a recovering sex addict. I cannot begin to count the number of times I've spoken those words in the past 20 years. Mm. How I wish I could say I've had 20 years of continuous sobriety. But the truth is, I've enjoyed numerous long periods of abstinence in recovery, with occasional bouts of sobriety thrown in. Mm-hmm. I've been abstinent from acting out for as long as 5 years, followed by a slow but certain slip back into the abyss of acting out hell. Mm. My addiction has successfully destroyed 2 marriages, so now I'm accepting that I shall be single and celibate for however many years God gives me here on earth. I'm 56. Both of my marriages made it just past the 16th anniversary before coming completely undone. I spent most of my adult years, including most of my recovery years, believing I was the only married Christian man struggling with same-sex attraction and giving in to the cravings. Only very recently have I learned that I am not alone. Mm. On about May 25th of this year, I will gratefully acknowledge 2 years of abstinence, recovery, and sobriety. Mm-hmm. They are 2 of the best years of my life, in spite of the fact that I'm in the process of divorce again. Mm. I doubt I shall ever really understand all that is different about this trip down recovery lane, but something is drastically different. Mm-hmm. It's working, and I am so very thankful. I have recently started describing my recovery program as a wheel. The wheel has many spokes, and I find that I'm adding a new spoke now and then. The most recent spoke is the book Samson and the Pirate Monks and joining the online brotherhood. Other spokes include SAA 12-step meetings, Celebrate Recovery, personal counseling, Covenant Eyes on my computer, making myself known and accountable to my church elders and pastor. Mm-hmm. My pastor gets my Covenant Eyes report. Mm-hmm. And deliberately working to develop some healthy male friendships, which were totally non-existent until 2 years ago. And the hub of the wheel is this. I get up early every morning to read my Bible and pray. Big deal, you say? No brainer? I tried for years to read my Bible and pray as I went to bed. That never worked. I couldn't keep my eyes open or my mind focused, especially if I was in bed. I'd fall asleep with my Bible on my chest every night. I finally realized that if I'm going to get anything out of this Bible, I have to do it at the start of the day. Mm. So I set my alarm 15 minutes early and started reading. It only took me 2 days to realize that this had an impact on my whole day. Starting my day with God made the temptations and cravings much less intense and much more avoidable. So I set my clock back another 15 minutes because I needed more time. Over the next few months, I set my clock back 4 more times. Mm. I now have 90 minutes every morning for reading and prayer. Mm. My wife casually mentioned one day that she was writing her prayers and that was becoming a real blessing to her. That was another aha moment for me. I've always had so much noise in my head that it's hard to hear what I'm reading and hard to concentrate on it. So I started writing my prayers every day.
Wow.
What a blessing. Mm. It causes me to slow down, to take more time, to be more deliberate and focus on what I'm praying. And an added blessing is the ability to go back 6 months or a year and see what I was praying that day and know now, without a doubt, that God has been answering.
I like that. Mm.
I thought at first that the daily reading and prayer time was just another spoke in the wheel. I now realize it's actually the hub of the wheel. I can remove a spoke, if necessary, for a short time and not be in trouble or much at risk. I cannot afford to have any spoke missing for very long, and it's really dangerous to take out more than one at a time. But I cannot, must not, dare not mess with the hub. Mm. Without the hub, I'm flat on my back, useless, and going nowhere.
Wow.
A friend of mine from Celebrate Recovery loaned me his copy of Samson and the Pirate Monks. He had only read a little of it, and he needed to focus his time on graduate studies for now, so he handed it to me and said, "Read this." I don't think he has any idea the impact of that moment.
Mm.
As soon as I finished reading it, I got online and ordered my own copy so I can read it again with a highlighter in hand. I've known in my head forever that this recovery journey is best traveled with somebody. But I really did not appreciate how essential the brotherhood is until I read the book. Now, I've listened to many of the podcasts and I've participated in the chat room. I've also determined that I'm going to make at least one phone call per day to a brother in my circle of friends.
Mm.
So, why am I writing? I'm not in desperate search for answers to my struggles. But I was first intrigued by and then powerfully struck by the message and the fellowship of the Samson Society.
Mm.
I'd been slowly crawling out of the pit of lonely self. But after reading the book, listening to the podcasts, and chatting some, I've been powerfully encouraged and empowered. There's no fast track to recovery for me, but the message of Samson has both encouraged and propelled me forward with greater momentum. I just want to say thank you and to share this much of my story. It is working. I have three brothers in the process of reading the book. We already participate in Celebrate Recovery together, and we're talking about forming a chapter of the Samson Society in Montana.
Ah, yeah, we're in the Cowboy Pirates.
That's it. Pray for us, please.
Hmm.
Now, in a way, what Denny has written kind of follows the line of a good, solid share in a Samson meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but as I read the letter, there were parts of it that I could identify with. I found myself nodding. There were good suggestions. I was reminded of some things I've forgotten.
Wow, yeah.
He brought experience, strength, and hope
right
to the fellowship. That was a great letter. Thank you, Denny. Thank you
that
very much.
That was really great.
Yeah.
Hey, we'll be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast. Yeah, baby, we are back on the Pirate Monk Podcast from SamsonSociety.org. We would encourage you to send your letters and your questions and your suggestions for what you'd like to hear on upcoming episodes to letters@SamsonSociety.org. Nate, you told me we just hit a real watermark, a watershed moment there.
Yes, we did. We now, we just registered a couple days ago the 3,000th member on the social networking site at SamsonSociety.org.
Hmm.
A guy named Steve-O was
Steve-O!
Number three, was 3,000.
Thank you, Steve-O, for your generous
No, he took the leap. I mean, he actually signed up and got himself a page.
Right, because like it is not when you identify with the brotherhood, you are saying I am a mess.
That's right.
On
exactly.
some level. You're saying
right.
that, you know, and you're admitting to sin. So I think that's a big deal. And one of the reasons why you were also telling me we had another threshold.
We also crossed the 10,000 subscriber mark on this very podcast after only 5 months on the air.
And we thank you guys for that. But I guess I shouldn't say guys. I should say guys and gals because you were saying that.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. I don't know how many women listen to the podcast, but I get the impression, and we get letters from them.
Yeah.
I came home last week, and my wife Allie was on the porch talking with a woman who turns out she's the wife of a Samson guy, and they were having a nice conversation. And so I said hi, and we had some small talk, and then she made a comment about the podcast,
right?
Something she'd liked. And I said, oh, you listen to the podcast? And she said, of course. She said, I love this. She said, I'm a chick monk.
Chickmunk.com. I think we have a new website. Well, I would love to know where we got all these women listeners. I mean, I'm not really sure. I mean, besides your sexy voice and all that.
Well, your Facebook page, I think, really is what's pulling them in,
yeah,
David.
Yeah. I'm sure that the picture of me and my wife on there is, like, really drawing them in. So, but you know who I'd like to ask is, we have a guest today. And her name's Constance Rhodes. And she struggled for many years with a subclinical eating disorder. And today she's the founder of FindingBalance.com, a multifaceted organization dedicated to helping people achieve balance in the areas of eating, image, and lifestyle management. And
I've been talking about Constance off and on.
Off and on for like months.
Months. You know? And I am just so thrilled.
We had lunch with her a few weeks ago, and just it was a great time. And she's written a book, and she's writing another book now. But the one that we're going to discuss a lot of today is a book that she wrote called Life Inside the Thin Cage. And so we're going to be talking about skinny girls and pirate monks and chick monks today here on the Pirate Monk Podcast. We'll be right back. Back at SamsonSociety.org's Pirate Monk Podcast. And Nate, you brought a friend with you today, and I'd like for you to introduce her.
Well, Constance, it's such an honor to have you with us here on the podcast. I've been wanting you as a guest since we first got started. You were on the dream list of guests right from the very start.
Really?
You were, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because in the conversations that you constantly take me by surprise, and you make these little comments, you make these connections that I, in my blissful male ignorance, would never have made.
Mm-hmm.
And you see connections between your world and our world.
I do. And I remember when we first met, and, we'd been hooked up by a friend of ours, Robert Beeson.
Yeah.
And you came over to my office. And I think you were being nice to Robert, maybe. I don't know. But you came over to my office, and you were sitting in there. And I started telling you about the work that I do at Finding Balance and something we have called the True Campaign about, all women stuff. And and you were sort of looking interested, but not really. And then suddenly I said something about the connection and how pornography and eating issues are interrelated. And all of a sudden, you were there, like for the first time in the meeting. You were like, really? You like woke up, okay. I saw your eyeballs for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think you were finally like, now I know why I'm here. And I was excited to meet with you because there is a huge correlation between the work that you guys do with Samson Society and the work that we do with women. It's so interrelated. I think we often split those things out. And men's issues, I think, as as true as it is that men feel weird talking about their issues and admitting their brokenness, I think there's been a wave of that for many years, but the women's stuff stays buried. And so for us to be able to talk together and sort of hit guys and gals at the same time, I think is a good thing to do.
Yeah, and not to get ahead of the story, but we are dreaming about that.
We are dreaming. I have a lot of things in my brain. I know. Are we going to reveal what we're dreaming about?
Maybe we will. I don't
Maybe
know.
We'll tease the Maybe audience we'll just a bit. Yeah.
Because I already have plans for you 2 Junes from now.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Wow.
You don't know about that part yet.
All right.
Yeah.
But, hey,
yeah.
I want to know where you were born.
Okay. I was born in Michigan.
Michigan.
Grew up in Michigan till the age of 16 and went down to a little Bible college that your wife went to.
Oh, CFNI.
Christ for the Nations.
That's right.
In Dallas. Really tiny school.
Carrie Jo B. Is that how you say it, her name?
I don't know her, but she was from there. A lot of great people came out of there.
You were a Christ for the Nations
Brothers
person.
Dad.
Wow. Yeah, Kevin Jones.
Yeah, Kevin Jones.
Okay.
Yeah, he and Nicole.
Yeah,
good
Christ
friends.
For the Nations, real small school. Went down there with dreams of being a singer, but I went too young, and I was too young to get in the group. And actually, college is where all my eating craziness
Of course,
began.
The group is Living Praise.
Group was Living Praise, which and I did end up getting in the very
Bob,
end.
That's
used to be Bob Mason.
Bob Mason.
And
yeah.
when your was your wife in with Bob?
Yes,
I
with
saw
Bob.
Him last October. Yeah,
I got to see him quite a lot too. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a good guy. In fact, he just called the other day. But so that's great. So you're down in Dallas or Carrollton or wherever
Dallas.
That is.
Yep.
And then you're too young to get in the group. Is that
too
what
young to get in the group. And actually what happened was I arrived at camp. So I was 16. I would have been 17 in a couple months. And for some reason, they didn't notice that on my application. I don't know. But they let me come. But I write about this because it was a pivotal moment in my own sort of identity. Is I went down there all independent, you know, thinking I was the stuff, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be in the singing group because I was the girl at church that always sang. And everybody always said that, right? And I get down there, and not only did I not make the singing group because I was too young, but they also the first week went, oh, she's too young, and they put all these weird restrictions on me. Like the first was that I could not leave campus with a member of the opposite sex unless I was in a group of people with an odd number of girls or guys.
Wow.
The trouble for me is I've been thinking about this lately because I'm going to talk about it at a conference in a couple weeks was at that time I'd only learned how to be friends with guys. I had disengaged from women, which I don't know how many of your listeners could maybe relate to that. But I know in my own story, like sort of my mom had, we talked about this before we began, my mom had kind of disappeared out of the picture early on. I didn't have a relationship with her in my family. Everybody was for themselves.
Yeah.
I didn't really have a relationship with them. And I began, and I wasn't very popular in school. Nobody liked me. I was a kid that got picked on a lot. And so I began to identify early on what made me important. You know, you kind of cling to that.
So, but, Constance, when you say disappeared, you actually mean she like left.
Well, my mom struggled with bulimia. That's part of the story. But ultimately what happened is she got married at 15 to my dad. So about the time she was 29, she was like, hey, I'm ready
put in my
to
time.
Live life.
Yeah.
And actually, interestingly, as we're going to get into some of this sort of more sexual-oriented stuff, my mom was a very attractive, very bright, very articulate woman who men liked to look at. And my mom had a lot of wounds inside of her. And I think that she reached a point around 28, 29. She was in the working world now. She began to get that attention. That was feeding a need that she had. And she ended up having an affair on my father. That's really what ultimately led to the divorce. And then she went on and she lived, you know, 40 minutes away or something. We didn't see her much. And at the same time, her bulimia, which is like a drug addiction, can be really crazy, was kind of taking her life over. So she was, I would see her occasionally, but she was not present for me. So there was no nurturing. And I know when I was reading your book, Nate, last night, just seeing that your mom, you know, was out of the picture when you were that young at the age of 9 and relating to that giant hole that leaves that I think of now that I have a 9-year-old. But yeah, so growing up, the thing for me was, okay, I figured out I had two things. Well, there was like one thing that I shouldn't have, which is needs. Right? Because you don't want to be a burden on anybody.
Right.
And the two things that I had that I thought I could hang my hat on. We didn't have any money, didn't have nice clothes, but I had a good figure. And I knew it and I liked it. There were things I wish I had more of, but overall I was happy. I was thin and I liked my body. And secondly was I had this talent to sing. At least everyone told me that. And so I had these two things. And I went to college the talent thing sort of got sidelined because I couldn't get in the group. And then because I didn't know how to interact with women and now I had these restrictions about not hanging out with guys and I began to feel really lonely, I began to binge eat. And in a really short period of time, I put on 15 pounds, which everybody talks about, the freshman 15. I'd never heard of it before. But so suddenly these two things were stripped away, and that's where a lot of my problems began to evidence themselves.
So then became, it's interesting to me, you talk about in your book subclinical eating disorders.
Yeah, I can tell you about that. Basically, whenever I say what I do, I run an organization. I've changed it out to health and wellness. People think of eating disorders as anorexia, the girl who's so skinny she's can barely move, or bulimia, the girl who's always puking. That's the two things. But the reality is that 3 out of 4 women, and many, many guys, lots of guys listening to this, have an unhealthy relationship with food. Well, they call that sort of subclinical, or there's a term, EDNOS, eating disorders not otherwise specified. And it's your chronic dieters, your obsessive exercisers, your organic food obsessions. Very cool thing to do, right? But it can become too much. All the crazy Christian diets, all that stuff. Where it's taking so much of your brain. And it affects you in a variety of ways. And people don't really talk about it because it's like, unless you're dying and need treatment, then this is fine. Probably like the work you do. Like, this isn't tearing my life apart. My marriage is still together. I have a great job. So it's this little side thing that I have. So what? But it takes over.
Yes.
I know that people at church probably wouldn't like it, but, you know, it's not really, you know, tearing my marriage apart.
No, and even in the church. Like, that's the only thing you can do is eat at church. You can't drink, you can't have sex, you can't do anything, but you can all have eat. You can all eat together, fried chicken at the church potluck, and joke about how you stuffed yourself silly, right? It's okay.
I've always thought that that's unusual, that people who do eat, like, in an unhealthy way, like, to where they're, you know, not just clinically obese, but then just like morbidly obese, you know.
Well, you've got that, but honestly, it's just as bad to be on the other side. Beth Moore did a great talk. It became the foundation for a lot of what we do. She said if you have obsession on one side, so you're always thinking about it, always worried about it, and you have carelessness on the other, those are both just as bad. You know, so the person who's a little overweight may say, well, at least I'm not anorexic. Well, both of them are in bondage, really. But what we want to move toward is respect. So we're making decisions about food. It could be anything, but in our case, about food, that respect who we are physically, emotionally, intellectually, relationally, spiritually. It's all those pieces. But especially the relational part, which is why I resonate so much with the work that you guys do with Samson Society.
I want to go there. Let me ask you this. You mentioned that a lot of guys, a significant percentage of guys, have an unhealthy relationship with food. And are ashamed of that, feel very weird about it. And that reminds me of the letters that I get from women who say, you know, I know you think that sexual compulsive activity is a guy's problem. And that's what everybody thinks. But, and then I hear some terrible, I mean, heart-wrenching story of a woman just trapped in loneliness, finding herself violating her own most deeply held moral principles, doing things that she finds in her more rational moments, in her, when she's connected to her real self, things she would never do, she's finding herself doing. Can you relate to that, and can you help
us? I can relate to that. I actually wrote about it in my book. I'm looking for it because it's here you go. Sex appeal does not equal true acceptance. I wrote a whole chapter about it. What I found in my own story was, The short story, you can read the whole thing in the book, but the short story is, I gained the weight in college, the harder I tried to control it, the more I gained, the bigger I got. Well, finally, after a few years of that, I got a grip. And when I got the grip, my weight came back down to what was more normal for me. Now, at this point, I was very obsessed with it, but I looked the way I wanted to look. And I began to really thrive on attention from men. And without even realizing what was happening, now at that time, I was living in sort of a wild area of Dallas. I was actually living in the Cedar Springs area, which was actually the homosexual area, but very sexually charged area. I didn't struggle with same-sex issues, but I was surrounded by people who were very... I mean, it was nothing to have a one-night stand. That was just, that was not a bad, in the culture I was in, that was not a bad thing. And I began to realize that I was doing these things all the time. And I, let me just read you this. oh, dang it, it's not the right journal entry. But what I began to realize was that I was constantly having sex. I didn't realize I had a compulsion. Mm-hmm. No, again, you know, I wasn't in relationship with anyone who would have identified that. Mm-hmm. But I wrote in my journal, why do I keep doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I keep doing this. I don't want to do this. For me, it wasn't a love attachment at all. It was all about a mm-hmm. feeling, and then I was done.
Right.
And then there was that dirty feeling afterward.
Yeah.
But there was something that it was fueling in me. It was my need. I think what I figured out was it was my need to feel in power or control over something.
Mm-hmm.
And here I knew that I could flirt with the guy and make this thing happen. And that was going to boost my feeling about how important I was.
Mm.
And I was going to be the one taken from him.
Yeah.
That's how I looked at it, because I didn't want his love or anything. I mean, it was like, yeah. I'm done with you. Goodbye. You know, that was the opposite of what I think. I always thought women were the ones who the men took from. I sort of enjoyed taking from the guy. We could probably spend hours figuring out why.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that was a huge compulsion for me. And it is interesting how so many women... Nobody talks about that. So when I say eating issues, they think women. And when we say sex issues, we think men.
Right.
Reality is they're very intertwined, which is why you and I are talking about doing the Sex and Skinny Tour. That's the name of it, which I think is going to be so great to look at how those weave together.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so much shame involved on both sides of that for all parties.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I have a ongoing discussion with a friend who says that women who struggle with sexual issues they're just sort of freaky because they were abused and that sort of thing. And I tend to disagree with that. I'd love to know what your
I'm not a clinician, so I can't give you hard and fast numbers. But you know what
experience.
I know? I know that a large majority of women, girls, are abused. But in my own story, I really don't think that was it.
Right.
I really don't. I mean, if you look back into my past, you know, we moved across the street from a family who took their kids to nudist camp, okay, when I was five.
Right.
That was our influence. And I remember the kid stripping on the trampoline and us thinking, what in the world are they doing? And the kids were, like, in the hot tub naked with their parents and their parents' friends.
Right.
So I was exposed to that, not directly, but just sort of knowing what was going on over there.
Yeah.
And us kids played around and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's always a matter of that.
Yeah, I mean, you're the fourth or fifth woman guest that we've had that has had, like, some kind of ongoing struggle either with porn or liaisons or whatever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And almost all of them have not been abused, but then they go on to get abused after the fact.
That does happen.
You know what I mean?
As you get in there, and you think it's, and I don't know if it's the same with the guys, but you think, I can handle this.
Right.
I'm in control.
Yeah.
I'm the one calling the shots. But at the end of the day, there's something stripped inside of us, I think.
Yeah.
It's sort of like so intangible, you can't really just get to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then that shame that's in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I know I still struggle with shame. Actually, I was on the phone with John Townsend last week, the Boundaries guy, because he's speaking at our conference in June.
Really cool.
I just have to tell the story. So I was talking to him, and we're setting up this role play thing at the conference. And we're just talking about all these details, and all of a sudden we kind of wrapped up what kind of person we're looking for to do the role playing. He goes, so do you do a lot of role playing? And I said, me? No. And I kind of laughed. And he goes, why'd you laugh?
Ooh.
I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm just thinking really quickly, how do I deflect this off of wherever he's going? And he goes, well, we were going along just fine. And all of a sudden, you just kind of laugh like, what was that? And I'm like, what, are we in a session? I don't even know this guy, you know, like I know who he is and I want him to think that I've got it together.
Right.
And he says, I said, okay, well, let me think about it. Okay. Well, I'm really more of an introvert unless I'm working, and then I'm an extrovert. But I guess if I were to get up there on that stage, I wouldn't know how to do it. Like, I would want to do it right. He says to me, he goes, well, we should probably find someone who doesn't have shame issues to do it.
Oh.
And he wasn't being mean or anything, but I've spent the whole weekend going, shame issues. Like, we like to think that we're beyond that. But, man, that stuff goes deep.
Deep.
And especially with sex addiction, I know that shame just...
Because it's looked upon so badly.
Right.
Yeah.
Talk some more about the similar mechanics.
Okay. Right. I want to read to you, I read this to you at lunch, I think, a few weeks ago. This is actually one of the counselors who's worked with us for many years, but her name is Leanne, and she said, the person who struggles with pornography thinks, when I'm alone with a pornographic magazine or internet site, or I'm watching an adult video, I am in control of everything I'm feeling. We talked about that. I do not have to enter into a deep relationship with the other person. I do not have obligations to him or her. I decide when and where it will happen and how often. I take what is actually my inability to feel safe with another human, and I control it all for myself so that I feel safe. So I'm the captain of my ship. Come on, right? And then she says, similarly, the disordered eater thinks, this is a game I play by myself. I decide what I eat, what foods are safe or not safe, what new technique I will use to control my weight. Instead of entering a deep, nurturing relationship with others, I keep my true self at a distance. I would say that's probably one of the biggest things is that false self. You know, this is who I am. I don't want to let you see. I make my body an object. I mean, that's very similar. I can manipulate because it is through that control that I'm able to feel safe. In my little world, I play all the games I want. I deny food and feel the rush. Or I eat too much and feel the condemnation. The goal is to spend time being in control so that I can feel good and safe and satisfied. And what I would say a moment ago, you said it's for skinny people, but this is, you know, overweight, underweight. It's whenever our relationship with food is out of balance. It's indication of our real relationships. Either non-existent or out of balance.
And it could even be like not even eating, but like it could be working out.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Nate and I are probably those guys, you know.
You're right, right. You got, I'm looking at you now going, no, I don't think that's a problem you struggle with.
Yes.
Praise
well, I have
Lord.
Conquered that.
We've conquered your weight obsession. We certainly have. So having said that, that there's this connection between the two, then I think that, you know, maybe it would behoove us all to go to people and show how it is all sort of obsession based, shame based kind of stuff and that connection. Because like when we went to the University of Florida, like we cut ourselves off from like about half of the audience because they were all women, right, Nate?
Yeah, exactly.
We know that there's a connection, but we're not really sure. And it's really interesting to hear you pull that out, to tease that out a little more, you know, and see the connection. And I think it would just be great to do
the Sex and Skinny Tour.
Skinny sex?
No, not skinny. Don't. You're taking it in a different direction. No, the Sex and Skinny. I think we need to explore how those things weave together. And it was actually a guy who you probably know, but I don't remember his last name, but he's a guitar player. His name is Michael. And he was the first one to say to me when I told him what I was thinking about doing this is when I just left the music business. And I was on a tour bus and I was describing the eating issues to him. And he was the one who said, you know, I guess it wouldn't be that much different from how a guy struggles with pornography.
Yeah.
And so since then, whenever I talk to men like Nate,
yeah.
first meeting, yes. I make sure to get that in there. And then their eyes open up and they go, oh, I think I understand what that is.
Yeah.
But they're interwoven, okay? There's the ideas about the body, you know, the culture overemphasizes the body. The church underemphasizes the body, almost shames the body. You shouldn't have
Absolutely.
A body that's attractive. You should hide under it, right?
Right.
So then there's even more shame. You can't win any way you go.
Except then you go to church and they're like showing the body and like you get to struggle there too. So
it's so hard.
And then the pastor has to get up and say, church!
What?
Y'all need to put some clothes on.
Well, and that it's really hard to know. And as women, I can tell you that, like, I'm mindful of what I wear. Even coming over here today, you know, my shirt buttons up way up here. But I don't always dress that way because it's not always comfortable. But you're trying to think of that and yet at the same time not have this view of I'm bad because I have a body that someone might look at. And
How can I balance that? Right. How can I it's no accident. I mean, I think a holistic view of the human person takes into account that we are an embodied spirit.
We are.
God put the spirit into a body. Jesus himself
exactly.
took on flesh. Right.
Right.
It's the incarnation. That's what we celebrate.
Yes. Right.
So we can adopt this crazy Greek view of reality where we just live in our head.
Right. The body's a tent. It's nothing else.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, it's
all
not what
the Bible does not say that.
Does
yeah.
not, no. So that I can actually, if I'm in poor physical health, that affects my spiritual health.
It does.
They are connected. So how can I appropriately honor my body And yet, if I'm a female, be modest.
Right.
Right? Without being...
Without feeling shamed.
Right, yeah.
You know what? Honestly, it's not always our fault that the guys can't help. You know, that the guys are going to...
Yeah.
My husband would say to me, I could look at a woman who has a paper bag on her head and who's significantly overweight, and I can still see what I want to see.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, how are we supposed to ever, you know?
And it's incumbent upon the man to get over his habit of objectifying women.
Right.
And to remind himself, sometimes on a second-by-second basis, that's not just a body, that's a person.
And you know what? Women,
that's a big deal.
Do you know, here's the thing. Women objectify us, too. We objectify each other.
Mm-hmm.
We look at women and study their bodies just like you do. Now, I may not want to have sex with that woman.
Yeah.
But I have objectified her body and figured out if it meets the parameters of what I think is just right.
Yeah.
And we do that to each other all the time. So both women and men have to somehow move away from separating the body from the person. And because it's a whole person we're dealing with.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know? Ann Jackson is another author who we've had on a couple of times. She says the same exact thing. It's like we objectify each other, too.
We
do. We look at each other and go, oh, I wish I had. I should have been, you know, where's that on me? And why doesn't she have? And and then they get enthralled with looking at
we
other
do.
People.
You know, why do women get Victoria's Secret magazines?
I don't know why do they.
I'm just saying, why do they look at them? I actually stopped my subscription because, well, I didn't have a subscription. They sign you up and send
you
14 of them. But I called and said, I don't want these anymore. And I wasn't even worried about my husband. It was, if I'm looking at these pictures, I'm comparing myself against them the whole time. I'm not looking at the clothes, really, most of the time. I'm looking at, how does she have that?
Yeah.
Did they airbrush there? I hope they did, because I don't have that. You know, like you're just objectifying.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's just sick.
Hey, tell us about the conference coming up.
Is
registration still open for
Registration is still open. This is the third year for the Hungry for Hope conference. It's the only Christian conference, as far as I know, for eating and body image issues. And I use that language. It's issues, not necessarily just eating disorders. But we do have a clinical track and a professional track. Dr. John Townsend will be there. We're doing what we're doing on this one is called Relationships Heal, R-E-A-L. It's all about relationship.
Oh, nice.
This is why I love the work that you guys do, because that connecting with others. So the first night, I'm going to just open it up and be, you know, pretty raw about how relationships and more accurately, the lack of them played into my own stuff. But we'll talk about relationships with peers, relationships with self, relationships with our body. So we've got some body things planned, body image workshops and really practical, like hands-on stuff, and relationship with God. We'll have John Lynch, the author of True Faced, there, which I keep telling you, you're familiar with that. So it's really a cool retreat. It's out in Colorado Springs at Glen Eyrie. So we have the conference in a castle, which is really gorgeous.
Wow.
This is where I want you to be 2 Junes from now, because we're going to do a whole conference on sex and skinny. And we'll get Marnie Ferry out there. And,
really?
Well, I'm going to ask.
Okay.
Why would she say no? It's gorgeous out
there.
Okay. But yeah, we'll do the whole thing on that. But yeah, this one is still open. It's June 4 through 6. It's pretty inexpensive registration, but you can find out at findingbalance.com/HFH for Hungry for Hope.
All right. And we do want our listeners to go to findingbalance.com. They can find your books there.
Can find books. They can find a library of more than 600 videos of doctors, nutritionists, counselors, all free, answering every question under the sun related to food and eating and nutrition and eating disorders and recovery. We also have a group like yours, only different. I might steal some of your ideas, but Finding Balance Gathering.
I stole them, so you can steal them from me.
Finding Balance Gatherings, this is a free support group tool that they watch a video each week, start their own groups, do a little worksheet together, and we have a 12-week curriculum. This is all designed specially for churches and sort of people who want that Christ-centered piece, which is not everyone, but, you know, there are those who do. So they can find out both of those at our website as well.
Fascinating. Well, Constance, again, just thank you so much for getting a babysitter for the kids.
That's right.
Canceling all the other appointments at the office, making the trip over here.
Surviving the flood.
Yeah.
Rowing out.
I know, I was bummed that we couldn't do last week. I was like...
I know.
You know, I was looking forward to this podcast, but...
You made it. We did it, and it was a wonderful conversation. Thank you so
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back on the Pirate Monk podcast. Stay with me tonight, Mom. Yeah. If you hear any noise, it ain't the boys, it's ladies now. So, Nate, Constance, great gal. I think that she has some wonderful ideas about how to connect our groups and some new ways to actually think about problems that people who have some maybe more conventional or traditional problems or problems that are just out there right now, where you can connect them back. And it's like, it is like when you sort of like flip the script and you like, you have a diamond or a chunk of coal for that matter, that you're like turning in to look at a different facet of it. It just goes, oh, wow. Yeah. And,
yeah, I really like what she brings to the table. Maybe men and women don't live on different planets after all.
That's right.
Maybe you look deeper. Maybe we're just on different continents. Or Maybe we're on the opposite sides of the same mountain. I don't know what I'm doing.
Maybe we're on the opposite sides of the same coin. Maybe we are. You know, I think the common thread, the common denominator, is the fact that we all feel a lot of shame and a lot of resentment, anger, fear about who we are, and we're really not sure that people will accept us just as we are. But you know that's what Samson's about, that's what Constance's whole thing is about, is like God just wants you to come just as you are.
He's not mad at you. He's not disappointed. His grace is greater still than all of your wrong choices. He is full of mercy, and He is ever kind. Here is invitation. His arms are open.
Come as you are.